Hello, team. As those of you who follow us on social media know, last weekend was San Diego Comic-Con, and I had the pleasure of wandering the madness with Cam Bowen and Eric Lopez. You can find pictures and video of us on Twitter and Facebook right now. We attended the Young Justice panel on Friday morning, and it was a blast. Cam and Eric have now both been officially announced as returning for Season 3. Congrats, guys. They also were kind enough to record a mini discussion session with me just after the panel. Patreon team members can hear that recording right now, and everyone will have access to that next Wednesday. So link over to patreon.com/crashingthemode to check that out. And with all that out of the way, let's get on with the show.
Recognized, Uncle Walker, D-0-1. Recognized, Emily of Arden, D-1-2.
Hello, team. Thanks for joining us for Episode 10 of Whelm, The Young Justice Files, Season 2. Welcome to the cave. My name is Rich, and I'm here with my, definitely not a sidekick, Emily.
Hey, everybody.
If you would like to get in touch with us, you can find us on Twitter at The YJ Files, on Facebook at Crashing the Mode, on our website, crashingthemode.com, on theyjfiles.tumblr.com, and at our email address, if that wasn't enough, whelmedpodcast@gmail.com. And with all that housekeeping out of the way, let's dive in.
What's going on in there?
Don't know. I'm cut off aboard the bioship.
We're fighting Black Beetle and Shimmer. Lagoon Boy, Robin, and Bumblebee are already down, and Connor, look out! Superboy's down. It's just Batgirl and me now.
You got to get in there!
What? How?
What do you mean, how? Density shift!
Right. I can do that. I can still do that.
Let's hand it over to Emily for...
Hello, Megan!
The title of this week's episode is Before the Dawn, which, if you were paying attention, is a nice little payoff from last week's episode, which is Darkest. If you know that little common phrase, Darkest Before the Dawn, find that clever. The release date was January 5th, 2013, several months after the previous episode, which came out on October 6th, 2012. We had to wait into a new year before we got new episodes, because what would Young Justice be without hiatuses?
Oy.
It's just the best release schedule.
Yeah.
The in-episode date was March 30th through 31st. The director was Tim Navarre, and the writer was Kevin Hopps.
Our special guest voice credits, Kevin Graveau, back as Black Beetle. Starting to get a lot more action. I love that Beast Boy's voice actor is also named Logan. Did you notice that?
I didn't, no.
No, his name's Logan Grove, voicing Garfield Logan. It's got to be funny.
That's great.
It's like when I lived on Howard Avenue. And then, of course, the amazing, always amazing, sorely missed Tim Curry as G. Gordon. That's about it, though.
Yeah, as it goes on, we get less and less special guest voice actors, I feel like, because people just become regulars.
Yeah, I know. Fewer and fewer people, they just fold into being regular cast members. That's true. Yeah, let's get into this mission.
Just in time for your next mission.
So in our pre-credit scene, we see how Jaime became Blue Beetle, only to have him wake up from what was apparently a nightmare in a containment pod in an underwater alien lab. Just completely normal situations.
Sure, as one does.
He is unable to escape and can only watch helplessly as the aliens discuss the fact that his scarab apparently malfunctioned before attaching itself to him. And then out of the shadows steps a hulking figure in power armor, eerily similar to Blue Beetle's.
So creepy. Post-credit scene, Calder is being taken on a lovely tour of said underwater lab by a member of the Reach. The ambassador, actually. He learns a bit more about what the metagene research is and why members of the team needed to be kidnapped. In short, the Reach is attempting to weaponize the gene that allows people to gain superpowers when under environmental stressors. We also learn that Blue Beetle isn't being kept with the other abductees because while he may be human, he is apparently of the Reach and is hands-off.
Super ominous. We then cut over to a harbor in Star City where a group of civilians are being abducted by Tigress, who we, the audience, know is Artemis. Batgirl, Robin, and Bumblebee infiltrate the group and get taken prisoner as well. Nightwing and a squad on the bioship then track their progress, hoping it will lead them to wherever Lagan and the others are being held. We then get another one of Jaime's nightmares, this time featuring Tai Longshadow. Jaime wakes up just in time to hear the Reach scientist explain that he can't be the Reach's operative on Earth if his scarab is malfunctioning and that they'll have to reboot it to fix it, which would kill Jaime in the process.
Lovely. Nightwing then sends Miss Martian in. She's able to track down Beast Boy and Impulse, while Batgirl and Robin are placed in the same lab as Lagoon Boy. Nightwing orders everyone to act before it's too late, and the plan to save our boys is set in motion. In a brief fight scene, we also find out that Connor infiltrated the base as a Manta Trooper and has secured a way out for the team and civilians. And really gives Artemis a pounding. He felt kind of bad. It's like, oh no.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Poor Artemis. So most of the team continues to fight their way out while McGann and Garfield try to track down Impulse, who ran off to find Blue Beetle. Everybody's running off in different directions. But along the way, McGann runs straight into Aqualad, and in one of the biggest, oh my god, no, moments of the series, she attacks his mind. At the same time, Black Beetle, the giant powered armored individual we saw earlier in the episode, confronts the team and locks down the room, preventing anyone from entering or escaping.
So I love that when he starts laughing, and I can't remember who said it, but they're like, that's not good.
That's not good.
That's not good. Impulse is finally able to find and free Jaime. Impulse is finally able to find and free Jaime, which is actually kind of interesting too, because we get to see that he can vibrate through walls with no problem, and we see that through this season and know that poor Wally can't. McGann's attack on Calder reveals her. Impulse is finally able to find and free Jaime. McGann's attack on Calder reveals to her that Artemis is alive and that Calder's been working undercover for the team. But by the time she discovers the truth, it is way too late. She has gone too far. Tigress then rushes in, and she and McGann share a silent moment where McGann realizes that, yeah, Artemis is alive. Before Beast Boy tries to attack Tigress, Tigress retreats, taking Calder with her, and Beast Boy, unaware of what's actually happened, leads a stunned and agog McGann back to the main action.
In that fight, the team is throwing everything they've got at Black Beetle, but he's taking down everyone without a problem. It's just super easy for him. We then get a brief flash forward as Bart explains to Jaime that in his future, the Reach succeeds in rebooting the Scarab and turns Blue Beetle into one of the worst villains in history. Impulse also reveals that the main reason he came back in time was to prevent that from happening.
One of them, anyway. One of the reasons. McGann, Beast Boy, Impulse, and Blue all eventually make their way into the fight, but by that time, almost everyone's been taken out. Jaime allows the Scarab to take control of the armor, which allows him to hold his own for a while, but then Shimmer accidentally uses the superpowers she apparently just developed, thanks to the Reach, and causes the room to begin flooding at a high pressure depth. As the bioship also begins to fill with water and the team can no longer go back, they're forced to leave Blue behind.
As the bioship retreats under heavy fire, Blue is pushed out of the lab and into the ocean, where Lagan is eventually able to rescue him. But while the mission may have succeeded, McGann is still just blue screen of death over her encounter with Calder. And later on in the Watchtower, Nightwing tells Captain Atom to announce the Reach's secret invasion to the world. But it turns out the Reach have just gone public and announced their presence to the UN, pretending to be peaceful ambassadors, meaning that any attempt to warn the public would only be met with disbelief at this point. And just as Nightwing says that at least we know what we're up against, we hard cut to an army of Reach ships deep in the Marianas Trench, because nothing can ever go right this season.
That's right. Or in Young Justice. Period. Right. Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah, there's some Gigantor Aster feeling. Let's do this business.
Let's go.
Superboy, are you all right?
I'm fine. Feeling the Aster.
So let's see. I get to talk about... Oh no, that's crashing the mode. I was going to tease you. Okay, go ahead, Emily. What do you got on Aster? I got a few.
Okay.
Let me take some wild guesses as to what's on the top of your list. I'm just thinking your girl doing terrible things to people.
Maybe.
Terrible things.
Yeah, no. McGann does some awful stuff in this episode. Like, what the heck? Oh my God. What? No. Bad. Insane. One word answers for how I feel about that scene. It's crazy.
It's crazy. And before I know, I'm going to let you off the leash here in a sec. But like when she says, she comes around the corner, the animation of her face.
Oh, God. It's
and then
so
she
good.
Just says the way that Danica McKellar just says murderer in this like growling, angry, like, I don't know how she managed to fit that much like passion in one word. Like you could just feel it all. And you just, I mean, and they have the timing enough to give that like beat pause just long enough for the dramatic tension for the watchers to be like, no.
It's all so good. Yes, so everything well done. You just said. I agree with all of that. All of that is good statements. Seriously, Danica McKellar is fantastic. And I love her. She's incredible. But that whole scene is so insane, and it's so well paced, and it does give you that one moment where you're like, oh no, this is the worst situation we could have possibly gotten into here.
None of this is okay. Coming back from this.
But I will say, with that scene, as much as I love it from a narrative standpoint, even though it like causes me pain because dear God, no, what are you doing? It also really frustrates me that they have that slideshow of Calder's memories as like everything unravels.
Yeah.
And it shows you all of season one and then hard cuts to flashbacks we see in season two to like him making the deal with Nightwing. And while I get that that's what we need to do to save cost on animation and to make things make sense and to cover the important things that we need to cover at the same time, I'm like, nothing happened in 5 years that mattered.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. I never, ever noticed that until I saw you put those notes in this outline. And now I'm bugged. Thanks for that.
I'm sorry. It's because I'm one of those people who literally, I just want to know everything that happened in the 5 years.
Yeah.
And I know we're never going to find out everything. But I'm like, just give anything.
Right.
Absolutely anything.
But they could have, I mean, they've done this kind of scene before with her where they showed her in a cheerleading outfit and her is an image of her white Martian form and, you know, those kinds of things back in season one. So I'm a little shocked and surprised actually now that you pointed out that they didn't throw just a couple of like little things that might have made reference to some stories from the comics, you know, or something like that, and then people could be like, oh, what was that? And then that would have them go online and research and find out there was a comic series and they could go look at it there, or you know, those kinds of things. But I mean, I get, again, like you say, from like a narrative standpoint, that trying to keep the momentum of the story moving forward and tight, you don't want to add a bunch of elements that aren't necessary, but you're right. The verisimilitude of that is kind of weird.
I understand why they do it, and it's fine. It's not that big of a deal, but at the same time, it's still going to frustrate me.
Yeah, I get it, though. I get it, yeah.
But aside from that, that scene is incredible, and the acting from everyone in that scene is incredible, and I do, besides just Danica McKellar's aggressive, ready-to-kill-anything-that-stands-in-her-way voice right afterwards, once everything has settled in and Artemis runs around the corner, they exchange two lines and it just breaks my heart where Artemis just says, what did you do? And she says, I thought he killed you, that he deserved it.
Yep.
Doesn't even say what she did. She's just like, I thought. And Artemis is like, oh no.
Yeah. You make your own implications about what I did, but I thought he killed you and that he deserved it.
Yeah, she doesn't even say it. She says, I thought he deserved, and then it just trails off.
Oh.
And I'm like, oh my God. And just the way that they animate both of them looking at each other and like her glamour charm just like slides away. And it's like,
yeah, because McGann can see Artemis's residual self-image in her own mind. Yeah, so good.
And then Beast Boy just attacks her as a tiger because we have to keep the story going. And I'm like, oh my God. Oh yeah. God. Can we not kill Artemis?
Yeah. Oh, I just realized the irony of the fact that Tigress was attacked by a tiger. He turned into a tiger to attack Tigress. Just hadn't noticed that before.
Beast Boy was like, puns. Puns. Middle of battle, but puns.
Right. And how it's just so painful with Gar just going like, good job. Way to go. You were a superstar. That must have been amazing. Like,
I'm sure it was very cool inside their heads. I'm like, no, boy.
There wasn't much to watch.
No.
But.
No.
She's basking in the glory of victory.
Yeah, poor Gar. No.
Yeah. Anyway. All right.
You want to move on to something else before I just start crying about Miss Martian?
Dude, Black Beetle. So, I think this is an accurate statement. Black Beetle is the first time I have been fully caught off guard and know nothing about a villain. Because this whole Beetle story arc, as I've said a few times, I didn't read the new Beetle and I didn't know much about him except that he had this alien powered armor. But I didn't realize any of this, like Reach, you know, history or any of that stuff was a thing. And so, you know, my wife had been asking me, who is this villain? And I'm like, I don't know. I don't know who this guy is. And then he comes out of the shadow looking like blue. And I, for the first time in the series, I was completely, everything was new. So I didn't know anything about the Reach. I didn't know anything about their tech. I didn't know anything about the Beatles. I didn't know anything about the agreement with the Guardians. I keep wanting to say Guardians of the Galaxy, but the Guardians. And so from here on in, I felt like a fresh new watcher, which was pretty cool. Also,
you became me in season one.
Black Beetle is horrifying for multiple reasons, but when I am a sucker. Here's a really random bit of trivia about me. I am a sucker for living bioships, like the Leviathans in Farscape, and back in the 80s, there was a great story arc in the X-Men called the Brood War, that they had these space whales, basically. We laugh, but it was a horrifying concept. The Brood were like, you know, they look like the xenomorphs from the Alien movies, because that was big in the 80s. But they were basically like these sentient parasites, and they would kidnap these huge giant space whales, and they would lobotomize them and then hollow them out on the inside and build cities on them. It was horrifying. She's like backing away from the mic, right? But like this whole idea of the... In Star Wars Rebels, they also had this kind of space whale thing. I just really think that living bioships are super cool. So that's one of the reasons why I love McGann's bioship and the fact that it's living. But then you get this beetle ship, which is almost like you could see a antagonist relationship between McGann's bioship and this beetle ship. She's laughing.
Where is my comic miniseries?
Right? Yeah, give me that fanfic, right? So when Black Beetle like reaches over and starts linking in with the ship, and I realize that the ship itself is shape-changing and armored and aggressive and all these things, like it could be all of these things, like my brain went into places that they never went in the show about this ship and all of these ships. You know, plus they have I'm big on underwater stuff, so the fact that they have this army in the Marianas Trench and they can have these ships at depths that, you know, we normally can't go to and that kind of thing. And then Beetle just laughs and takes down like 10 people, 10 superpowered people, including Superboy. It not only makes him a horrifying villain, it puts like crazy perspective on the power that Blue Beetle has. Like what he could do if you let him off the hook. You know,
speaking of Black Beetle and all of the power that Black Beetle has, this episode and him in particular includes the one scene in the show that like makes my skin crawl every time I see it. And it like the first time I watched it, it happened, and it happens every time I rewatch this episode. The scene where Black Beetle grabs Cassie just slams her against the wall. Messes with my head every single time I see it.
Yeah.
Because his lines beforehand are creepy as all heck. And just watching that, how the audio for that scene, the visual for that scene, the fact that they have to cut to everyone's faces because they can't show what is happening to Cassie because it's that messed up.
Yeah.
Just genuinely makes me flinch. And I'm like, this is a cartoon. I should not be flinching away from the violence.
Yeah, yeah.
But I do.
Right. Yeah. It's pretty brutal. And the fact that he fights so smart, too. Like, he sees McGann, and he's like, oh, okay. And then you're like, wait, what did he do? Like, they could have hand-waved that and said, like, oh, he just did something electrical and shocked her or whatever. But he's like, no, I just changed the density of the door. And I'm like, oh, my God, the implications of all, like, every layer of this and how he fights and what he does. I love the fact that, like, the last two up, I think, were Tim and Barbara, maybe? Like, was Barbara one of the last ones up? And Tim, like, no.
Because Batgirl goes down before Superboy, because Superboy is one of the last ones to go down. Because I feel like I remember hearing Wonder Girl shouts, like, Batgirl, look out, and then says Batgirl's down, and then a few minutes later, she's like, Superboy's down.
Okay, for some reason, that was Cass. I didn't think it was Cass. For some reason, I was thinking that was Barbara, but I think you're right. That was Cass.
It gets down to Cass near the end.
That's right.
Which is why they shoot to everyone else lying on the ground as they throw her against a wall.
You're right. That's right, because Barbara and Tim are unconscious laying on the ground in their shot, I think. Yeah. Yeah, you're right. Brutal. I have, like, this super minor picky thing about that scene.
Go for it.
And the minor picky thing would actually make it creepier, and I wish they'd have done that, was his line was a bit long and a bit of a mouthful and unnecessary in the length it was. Like, oh, you know, don't be jealous. I can put you halfway through the door, too, the hard way, or whatever. But he didn't need to explain all that. He could have been much creepier if he'd have just said, don't be jealous. And then started slamming, right? Yes.
No. I'm not okay with that.
Yeah. If he had just said, don't be jealous, and started slamming her into, like, and if they'd actually showed more damage to the wall, or even, like, literally him putting her through the wall, like, that would have turned that scene to 11. Sorry.
No, you were taking, like, the worst scene to watch and making it worse, and I didn't know that was possible.
Sorry. I'm always big on trying to see where you can trim down dialogue for effect. And sometimes it's hard when you're writing the dialogue yourself. Sometimes it's hard to edit yourself because it's hard to get perspective. Like, what information have I given to the readers, and what do they take away from them, and that kind of thing. And that's where it's nice. That's where it's really good to have an editor or alpha and beta readers when you're writing a novel, so that they can point out these things like, oh, you thought this made sense, but it didn't. Oh, whoops, I forgot. And I cut out a piece of information two chapters ahead of time or whatever, or vice versa. Like, you've repeated this four times in the last three chapters. We don't need all that information. Right. But it's normal. You lose track of that. So when I'm looking at dialogue, I'm always looking at ways to tighten it up and making it even more poignant. So
part of that might be that because it is technically a Saturday morning cartoon, some of that stuff that we're like, that's a good idea, they probably couldn't have done because of censors.
Maybe. Yeah.
But
I guess we could have put a little bit of that in a canary debrief, but a little mini canary debrief. A little early brief.
With that same scene talking about McGann phasing through the door and that whole thing, I love that it takes that to, like, break her out of that mode of just not being able to talk. I love that, and I love that from the minute she attacks Calder, she doesn't talk, she doesn't say anything. It takes Garfield dragging her places for her to get anywhere for a little bit.
Yeah.
And he tells her to do something, and she's like, what? Like, she can't even remember what her powers are, right, for a minute there. He's like, density shift through the door. And she's like, right, I can do that. I can still do that.
Right.
Like,
right.
Feels like she can't use anything else. She's like, I can do that. I can do that without hurting anyone. I'll just do that. And she's just, I love how they write her and how Danica McKellar acts her for the rest of the episode as just almost no words, all just right. not responding to anything. And I think that's just a really great way for them to do that and do that
I agree.
Little character bit for her.
But they had that whole scene had so much character development for a bunch of people, and some of it was pretty subtle. Like,
yeah,
Nightwing's the leader. He's been the leader. He's wanted to be the leader for 5 years. But when Barbara comes up and says, this is what we need to do, there's no Nightwing contradicting her or improving the plan or doing any kind of, you know, macho egotistical overlay. It's just him going like, got it, and going.
Yeah.
And like, Barbara's the plan maker, and he just doesn't bat an eye. No pun intended. He just goes with it.
With that, I love that even with that, she hands Bumblebee, who's unconscious, off to him. She's not like, I'm going to take Bumblebee inside. You go do the plan I just said. She's like, no, you take the unconscious teammate. I'm the one with the plan. And he's like, yeah, no, sure, go.
Right, exactly. And again, it should just be that way, but it's interesting when you start watching and paying attention to how these things evolve that people do these things weirdly subconsciously in writing, like not doing it on purpose. And each individual event, you're just like, oh, well, it's just the way it was for this event. But no, there's a trend of things like that happening across media. So it's nice that you have to be a conscious creator and focus on things like that to make sure that you're getting that happening, you know?
Absolutely.
And Beetle giving full control over to the suit, especially after finding out that if the Beetle could make him into a big bad and like seeing what Black Beetle can do, I was like, wow, okay, yeah, you've got to give over control of the Scarab, but you were just warned that giving over control of the Scarab could turn you into, like, that choice could not have been good or easy for him. And it also, considering how it worked out, it also is nice because it plants a seed of trust for the Watchers and Jaime in the Scarab.
Yeah.
Because it didn't do those things, right? But the situation was, you know, I'll talk about this in the Canary debrief, actually. We'll fold that into the Canary debrief. I was going to talk about Jeopardy. So the last thing I have is that I love this slow motion for Impulse as he's running around. And I love the fact that he's the one that saves Blue. I like that they keep that tight friendship happening. Like you said, it's chaotic. Like people are going everywhere doing their own thing, but everything they're doing makes sense. Like, to both move the story forward, but also make sense within the character interactions between them too, which is fantastic.
As little things, I also have that I noticed this watch through that they mentioned that Blue Beetle has only been Blue Beetle for 8 months, but he's only been on the team since December, if you read the comics. Yeah. So I just think that's interesting, that like how long this has been going on. I think it's cool to see how new to this he is. He hasn't even been a superhero for a year.
Right.
I also, as a little aside, I love that Connor shows up as a Manta Trooper. I know we said that in the thing, but I just love it. Because you go into this being like, where's Connor? And then it's like, oh, there's Connor. Nice. There's Connor being able to go undercover now because he like knows how to do this and still takes out everyone in 5 seconds. And is like, room secure. I got it. I'm like,
yeah,
yes, love it. I love seeing him get to do that. And as my final thing, I do say the scene on the bio ship when they're all going back and we mentioned Garfield's like, oh, she's just basking in the glow of victory. And like Lagan is hanging on her and like nobody thinks anything is weird except Connor. And I love that Connor is able to pick up on that and just, he doesn't know what happened. He has no idea what happened, but he knows that something's off. He's like,
yeah,
that's not how she acts about anything ever. And like, yeah, I just realized as I was saying it that Gar does say, she's like, oh, she took down Calder. And Connor's like, oh, no.
Yeah. But Connor doesn't know, right, at this point.
Yeah.
But he knows something's not okay.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, it doesn't sound like Gar's saying she murdered him. But it may have been worse than murder, like, because he knows. Yeah.
Yeah.
Again, with the facial expressions, you know, like you say, with the animation. Amazing.
Yeah. Because they don't have Connor be like, oh, I understand. It's like they just have Connor like raise an eyebrow in her direction like, that's not good. Whatever happened, it's not good.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's dive into the debrief here.
Go for it.
Stick around. Class is in session.
So the Canary Debrief is about appropriately increasing the jeopardy of your story, right? This episode is full of jeopardy about halfway through the season, right about where it should be with pace, right? Black Beetle takes out the team solo. We get the big reveal that this guy even exists, and then we immediately get to see what he can do. We've had 10 very interesting, exciting episodes of personal and inter-team drama, and now we get to see this big bad who turns everything to 11. The fact that the Reach has an army of ships in the Marianas Trench, the fact that the Reach just undermines the heroes by the simple act of introducing themselves ahead of time to the world before they can be quote-unquote outed. They are controlling information, they're controlling everything about them being there, right? The idea that Blue may become a terrifying threat to humanity, and then in that same episode showing Black Beetle being a reflection of what Blue can become, right? Calder being mind-fried by McGann that we've seen for 10 episodes building slowly up, planting the scenes for this one, you know, for many, many reveals, but this one gut punch reveal that you have to make a lot of story deposits in a bank to be able to get this kind of emotional withdrawal out for this kind of scene. When you're moving your story forward, jeopardy should increase, right? And you can do that by the success failure cycle. As the successes become a little larger, the failures also become larger until you get to your end, right? How you do that is not easy. It's just not. But you have to be a conscious creator and look at these things ahead of time. You can be a what's called a discovery writer. You can say, I have this quirky idea. I'm going to sit down and write an 80,000 word book and see what happens, right? And I know people who do that. I have friends of mine who are those kinds of writers. They get to the end of the book and they go, what is the story about? Oh, it's really about what the things that happen in chapters 4, 8, and 12. That's the focus. So I'm going to like rewrite and tweak everything in all the other chapters to find these beats, right? That's a discovery writer. As opposed to a plotter who has an outline and has checkpoints and knows where things are going to happen and turns and blah, blah, blah. Most writers, I think, fall between in the middle somewhere on some spectrum. It is a spectrum. But when you're dealing with jeopardy building, discovery writers who are very good at being a discovery writer do those things on instinct, where a plotter or planning writer will understand how things are building and know when to do the big reveals, making sure your villains are appropriate, working at their full capacity, characters working at their full capacity. We don't see Black Beetle take down the room full of people. We don't see a lot of the fight, but what we do see, we know people are working at their full capacity. And the stuff that we could see him knock Superboy unconscious, that's not nearly as dramatic as having somebody say, oh no, Superboy's down, and letting us fill that screen space in ourselves about how exactly that ended up happening, right?
Absolutely.
That's more horrifying. So just in that fight scene, the directing, the writing, the animation, what to show, again, what not to show, and then from a big picture standpoint with the plot, making sure that your villain's plot is moving forward, and if they're staying one step ahead of the heroes, we're worried, we're invested, we want to know how they're going to get out of that situation. So,
as for the first time ever, I'm going to throw out a tabletop gaming thing.
Nice.
For this.
Let's do it.
Because
I'm so excited.
I know, it's insane. This, what? I've only ever played 3 games. But people may know from the internet that I am a big fan of Critical Role and have been around from the beginning of that. And that, for people who don't know, is a web series from Geek & Sundry that is Matthew Mercer, a voice actor, and a bunch of other voice actors playing D&D and playing a very long game of D&D that they've been playing for years before they put it online. And with that, it is all improvised. It's not a scripted show. They just go forth and do, and the only things that are planned is what the DM plans. But with that, I can't even remember episode names or numbers anymore because it's been so long. But after the first few arcs of the show, after they'd gone through a few quests and done a few plot lines, they were getting to a point where all of the characters were kind of in their RP, were like, there's no reason that we're staying heroes. There is no reason it feels like that we are staying together as a group. They literally had a conversation between two characters in which one said, why are we still doing this? We've defeated the stuff that mattered, and now we all have our own separate things that we need to do.
Yes.
Keyleth needs to go finish her quest, and you have to go do this. And that episode, it ended up lining up that that was the exact episode, that was the game where their dungeon master was like, hey guys, dragons. There are five dragons here now. This is what you're, why you're still heroes.
Yeah, yeah.
So when it gets to that point in your tabletop game where everybody's kind of like, it doesn't make sense for us to continue doing what we're doing, DMs have to kind of step in and be like, okay, we're either ending the campaign or there is a new threat.
Right.
There is a new bigger threat. Because it went from a few little mini arcs of like, we have to go defeat some goblins under a mountain. We have to go avenge Percy's parents, to here's a 50 episode arc where dragons are here and we have to save the entire world.
Yeah.
You got to increase your enemies, especially because you're leveling up. If you're stronger, you can't just be going after goblins every
week. If you're interested, so Ishan Sherwood, who starred as Connor in our actual play, his podcast, Total Party Thrill, for the first, oh, I don't want to say 60 episodes of Total Party Thrill, which is a great show, they have a story recap of their Eberron campaign. Eberron is a particular Dungeons & Dragons setting that's kind of a very high in like Magitech stuff. Think of it like heavy magic, Lord of the Rings with heavy magic and Indiana Jones and Lara Croft mashed together. Right, so there's trains, but the trains are run by like lightning elementals and things like that. So they recap their campaign, and it's a full like 20 level arc campaign, and you can see how Ishan, who was running the game, you know, turns the Jeopardy up and changes the things and layers things up to the point where they're starting small, but they're ending up literally fighting a god and potentially changing reality. Right. And how you pace those things is important. And in a role-playing game, it's tough because you can make all the plans you want, but the players are going to do what the players are going to do. So, you know, no plan survives contact with the enemy. Right. So you have to adapt to that while still keeping your storyline tight and loose enough to be flexible. That's tough to do. It's actually, in some ways, a little easier to do when you're writing a story or writing a novel. Definitely. Because you have control, theoretically, of what the characters will do, keeping in mind that you can't make characters do something that their character would not do, because it will come across.
You theoretically have control as an author.
Make sure to listen to your characters when they're telling you stuff. Yeah, absolutely. That's a great example. And Matt's a super sweet guy. He's just a nice guy, and the rest of the crew is amazing. So you can go check that out if you enjoyed our actual play. They're incredibly entertaining. And I think he's going to be at both Gen Con and at San Diego Comic-Con doing some things with Critical Role.
The whole crew is going to be there at both.
Yeah.
Because there's no episode this next week.
Oh, because of Comic-Con? Yeah.
Yeah, because they're all going to Comic-Con and then they're doing an episode at Gen Con.
Right. All right, let's crash the mode. Let's get move on.
Yeah, let's crash the mode.
Tell us something we don't know yet.
Sorry, BB. We can't risk altering the time stream. We do that, we're all feeling the mode.
So in Crashing the Mode, we'll be discussing spoilers for Young Justice and the greater DC Universe. So if you are spoiler wary, consider this your warning. And I won't take it. Go ahead.
Yay! For the first time ever, I get to do the history of a character thing in Crashing the Mode, because this is one of my favorite characters in all of DC Comics is in this episode is in a cameo. It's my girl, Stephanie Brown. I love her so much. For people who don't know what the heck I'm talking about, in the scene with all of these civilians that are being captured by the Reach, there is a girl in a purple jacket, a blonde girl in a purple jacket with like a white scarf. That is Stephanie Brown. Her name is never mentioned in the episode, but it is in the credits. Like, always pay attention to the credits, friends. But for those who don't know, Stephanie Brown is a character from DC Comics. She is the daughter of Clue Master, who is a villain. She first appeared in the 90s as a character known as Spoiler, who was a kind of like freelance teenage vigilante just going about, and was became a supporting character in the Robin series that came out around the same time, because she was Tim Drake's girlfriend. She briefly became the fourth mainstream Robin, kind of because she thought her boyfriend had cheated on her and was like, if you're going to cheat on me, I'm just going to go be Robin, and just went and became Robin for a little bit. As one does. I like that was her response. She's like, he wasn't actually cheating on her, but she thought he was. And her response was like, fine, whatever, I'll just go be Robin. She then afterwards became the third Batgirl and had her own solo series that I love, that I own all of, that I tracked down all of through various conventions because I love it. She was dead for a little bit, for a little while in there, in the middle of all that. She was killed at the...
She got better.
Literally, she was killed during her short stint as Robin, which led to the heartbreaking line of her looking up as Batman while she's dying and saying, was I ever really Robin? And he goes, of course you were. Breaking my heart. But after she was brought back, they're like, it was just an elaborate ruse. She was never really dead. I'm like, okay, cool. As long as I get her as Batgirl, I'm fine with that. But after the DC Rebirth reboot, she came back as Spoiler, even though she hadn't appeared in comics for a while at that point. But she is my favorite. I love her so much. And hilariously, what I find quite funny is that this apparently proves that, because we're crashing the mode, I can say this, Tim Drake has a type, and it's blonde girls voiced by Mae Whitman. Because both Steph and Cassie are voiced by Mae Whitman, and it amuses
that
me
is
too much.
Hilarious. Oh, I love it. That's so funny. Stephanie is fantastic, and I'm looking forward to seeing what they do with her in the next season.
Bring her in as anything, and I will be happy. Like, even if it's one episode, I will be ecstatic. I love her so much. One of her quotes from her comic series was actually my senior year yearbook quote, because that's how much I love her. Was I am who I choose to be. And I like that. That sentiment, and I love her.
If you're wondering about like who Stephanie is as a character, I've heard it pretty easily kind of handed down as she's the Peter Parker of the DC universe. She's the a character who's trying to balance the real life, I got homework to do, I'm trying to live a normal life, with the superheroing at the same time. And I think it's a great, and if you find Peter Parker, when he's written well, endearing, because of that kind of quirkiness and him genuinely wanting to be a hero, then you will like Stephanie Brown.
I also really like that she's got little team supporting her a little bit. Like, Peter Parker to me always feels very solo in his trying to balance things.
Yeah.
Like, Oracle is a main player in Steph's solo series, because Oracle, they just talk on the phone through all of her missions. She's like, where's the bad guy? Oh, he's there? Cool. And they just have full conversations while fighting. She has a bunch of stuff with Damian that's really, really funny. She also infamously slaps Batman in the face and lives.
Oh, I didn't know that.
No, because there was an arc where Bruce Wayne was dead. And then I only know this was my first introduction to Steph Brown, was a one shot where after Bruce Wayne died, I say in quotation marks, and came back, they did a series of one shots where he was like telling everyone that mattered that he wasn't dead anymore. It was like Nightwing had become Batman and a bunch of other stuff, he had to go and tell everybody. And I picked up the Batgirl one shot for that at a sale at my comic book store. And he is like testing her to figure out whether or not she should be able to stay Batgirl, because she like became Batgirl while he wasn't around. And when she realizes that whatever villain she's been fighting was actually just Bruce Wayne messing with her, he takes off the mask and it's Bruce Wayne, and she smacks him in the face. And then her thought bubble just says, oh my God, 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 for like a full panel. And then she just runs. And Bruce doesn't get mad. He's just like, I kind of deserve that. And I'm like, this is the greatest character ever. And I love it so much.
That's awesome.
Go check out Steph Brown.
You should absolutely check out Steph Brown. That 2-year run is fantastic. I wanted to say, one of them is, if you want to hear kind of a dynamic of Steph Brown, go listen to the One Shot Podcast Network, hosted by James D'Amato. Did you hear that, Emily?
I did. That was one of the first APs that you sent me and was like, if you want to find out what this is, go listen to it. I'm like, I love it. I love this so much.
Yeah. Search One Shot Podcast Flight of the Robins. And you probably heard me talk about it before, and we chatted about it a bit with our interview with James D'Amato. But it is a collection of all the, you know, historical Robins and or Batgirls, and the adventure they're running really gets into this concept of their own histories and how they tie together and what these villains are doing. And you see a little Jason Todd and Tim Drake, and you get to see all these characters like interacting. If you enjoyed our actual play, you can go check that out. And I think that you'd really, it'd give you some insight into who Stephanie Brown is, her dynamic with Damian, et cetera, et cetera. If you don't know who Oracle is, was the other thing I was going to say. We've mentioned her, I think, a few times on the show because the Barbara Gordon Batgirl is still active in season two. In the comics, not now with the 52 and the rebirth, but before the new 52, Barbara was shot by the Joker and paralyzed from the waist down. So she could no longer be Batgirl, but she was already a librarian and a brilliant computer hacker. So she was given supplies by Bruce Wayne and became a character that called Oracle. And Oracle became like just everywhere in the DC universe. She was showing up in every comic. Nobody knew who she was, but she would be like talking into Superman's ear with his communicator, like Justice League communicator while he was on his comic. And if anybody needed to know anything about anything or get in anywhere, she was where you went. And I absolutely adored Barbara Gordon as Oracle. Why she became Oracle is a bit problematic. When she became Oracle, we had a very strong character, like a wheelchair-bound character who was brilliant and strong and powerful and a cornerstone of the DC universe. And I really would like to see that both representation back and Barbara really stepping into her own and not being just a shadow of the bat, you know? So,
yes.
Yeah, I have one crashing the mode myself, I think.
After sort my of. Steph Brown rant, because I love her so much.
It's so good. It's so good. But there's a comment made, and now for some reason, I thought it was in this episode, but now I think it's in another episode or maybe in the comics, this comment about Atlanteans being humans.
It's in that this episode.
Is it in this episode?
Yeah.
I couldn't find it, but Atlanteans being humans that have adapted in various ways to aquatic environments due to their metagene, which blows my mind and works really well with this concept of this continent that was sunk because of some disaster. And having this metagene be a thing that gets triggered under environmental stressors and seeing how many different species and things like that came out of, you know, Atlantis. Man, I just want to see so much more about the history of Atlantis. Also, I want to give a quick shout out. And speaking of that, let's get to the actual fan service.
I've admired your stance on animal rights for years.
So this week we have a new kind of fan service, not an AMV, no, not artwork. I'm actually going to recommend you follow and check out Nitai Dasa. That's at Nitai, N-I-T-A-I, underscore Dasa, D-A-S-A. Nitai is the brother of Quinn Wilson, who was the guest on our discussion episode talking about linguistics. And during that episode, you heard Quinn make many references to his brother, who is a linguist. That's Nitai. Recently, Nitai's been rewatching Young Justice and posting some absolutely fascinating comments on linguistics, including most recently he was talking about the Atlantean, the constructed language of Atlantean, and talking about its parallels and evolution and development in relation to ancient Greek and modern Greek, and analyzing what little written Atlantean he's been able to find, like from the comics, because even the subtitles don't have things, it just says like from Atlantean or whatever, it speaks Atlantean or speaks a foreign language or something on Netflix, which is less than helpful. Anyway, go follow Nitai and check out some of the stuff that he's putting. We're trying to repost some of it as well, but I think I missed a few. I've asked him to tag us in the future. Fascinating guy saying really cool stuff. So go check him out and ask him tons and tons of linguistic questions. I'm sure he would be excited to answer. And if not, sorry, Nitai, we just flooded your Twitter feed. I'll buy you lunch.
We're the worst.
We're the worst, giving you followers. Well, with that, I think we can wrap up this mission and head out of the cave. Remember, the best way to support the show is with a 5-star review on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. We would love to get, if we could get 10% of you listening, to pop over to iTunes and either just give a quick click on 5 stars or whatever stars you feel are appropriate, hopefully 5, or give us a review, even a short review of why you enjoy the show. I can't express to you how huge a help that is for the algorithm to help us end the show.
So we just want to remind you to keep hashtag buying YJ comics on Comixology, but we also have to say that you can't hashtag keep binging YJ anymore because it's not going to be on Netflix by the time this goes up.
You can keep binging YJ. You can even use the hashtag. It's not going to do anything.
Yeah.
Because as of, isn't it August?
August 1st.
Young Justice will no longer be on Netflix.
That is true. Instead, you can buy the show from Amazon or iTunes or wherever else you want to buy it. That still will register and help in some way, but it's just not Netflix anymore. You can also now use hashtag Young Justice Outsiders when you're getting hyped for next season, for season 3 that's coming next year, where it's happening. And if you want to help us get more episodes, more Secret Origins, more actual play podcasts, like the one that just wrapped up the week that we're recording this and people seem to be enjoying, and other things too, please continue to support us through Patreon, or consider supporting us through Patreon if you don't. For just a few dollars a month, you can help us do even more with the show while getting some great rewards for yourself. And remember,
stay whelmed, everyone.
You've been listening to Whelmed, the Young Justice Files podcast. Our hosts are Rich Howard and Emily Bouza. Our editor and producer is Neil Powell. Our theme was composed by Emily Mio. Our logo was created by Kevin Bates. Whelmed is a fan-made podcast and is not officially affiliated with DC Comics, DC Entertainment, Warner Brothers Animation, and any other owners of Young Justice or its related source material. As such, these companies have sole ownership of all symbols, images, names, logos, and proprietary material related to Young Justice. Original content of this podcast is ours under Creative Commons. Thanks for listening, and stay whelmed.